And so today's for today's lesson, we're going to look at two parts. We're going to break apart the passage in two different parts. The first part is we're going to actually go through the list that Peter gives us, mainly because the modern attachments to these vocabulary words are not what they were 2,000 years ago. Okay, some of them are, but not all of them. And then we're going to contrast it with verse 4. And so that's where we're headed. So we start in verse 3 with this list of sins that we see the first century Gentile Christians. This is what they used to do. And we know that Rome, ancient Rome, was very, in a lot of ways, very much like modern day America, except the fact that maybe, I guess, there were some differences, obviously, mainly in the fact that there were just varieties of polytheism and the way that those things functioned. It's a little bit different. So you don't see, for example, you know, going down the street, you know, like a huge Hindu temple or like a portable Hindu temple and stuff like that. Nonetheless, the main audience that Peter is writing to are people who are not born into Judaism, who are not ethnic Jews, and so they did not grow up with the Old Testament, learning about the Old Testament and stuff like that. And so when they had come and met Christ, it was a whole, it was a very big deal. It was a very big transformation. And so Peter here then lists for a specific purpose the different things that they used to do before they became Christians. And so he starts out with sensuality. Okay, sensuality, or in some other translations it says debauchery. Debauchery, I like that word because it just sounds really gross or really bad. Okay. Debauchery in different parts of the Bible, it refers to specific sinful acts. Not always connected with sexual sins, but a lot of times it is. Here, though, it is not connected, pointing to a specific thing, but it is used by Peter to refer to very general, general sinful actions. Okay, and so in verse 3, you can kind of see it as like his thesis point, right? He's saying, okay, so before you came to Christ, you used to practice debauchery. Okay, and so that's a general heading. And then he goes, and then he starts listing the very specific, exact things that are attached to that and what he wants to kind of point at. And so the first, I guess, point under the heading of debauchery or sensuality, as given in the NASB, is lust. Lust here isn't just talking about sexual desire, but it is also just talking about a sinful or evil desire for something. Okay, and so the Bible will use actually that word to describe our sinful desires for something that we shouldn't have. And so, for example, Genesis 3, Adam and Eve lusted after the fruit. Okay, that same idea. And so Peter, again, here is talking about lust in terms of our covetousness, right? That we covet things that we should not have. Drunkenness is exactly what it's talking about in modern times, and exactly what it sounds like, and which is getting drunk from excessive drinking, okay? Again, under the freedom of Christ, we are freed to drink. Okay. However, this is not talking about that. This is Peter talking about drinking too much. drinking to the point of getting drunk, or drinking to get drunk, okay, that is sin. Okay, drinking is not a sin. Getting drunk is a sin, mainly because it is the direct opposite of one of the fruit of the Spirit, which is self-control. Okay, so when you get drunk, you lose self-control. The NASB translates the next word as carousing. The NIV uses the word orgies. Okay? I wrote it and didn't even think about like the people that I'm going to be talking to. Anyway, again, this is just like the word lust. It is a word that is not exclusively attached to sexual sins. Okay? Carousing, or in the NIV saying orgies, it is not it is not what it sounds like. Okay, they did do those things, the ancient pagans. They did a lot of those things, usually attached to pagan worship. In case we say, oh, those bad Romans, ancient Israelites do it too. Okay, like right before they go into exile, before Nebuchadnezzar comes and destroys them with the Babylonian army, they are actually doing that in the temple of God, the temple that Solomon built in 2 Chronicles chapter 3. Okay, so that's pretty bad. Any case, this is not talking about that. This is talking about that word is actually a vocab which refers to an instance where apparently people used to get together and get drunk. And what they would do is they would, in their drunkenness, I guess, decide, hey, you know what? I think it's a good idea to go out in public and start singing out loud and basically just causing general unrest. And so in their drunkenness, they would start singing out loud in the public streets. Usually they would go to like a person's house that they know, or they would stop in front of the house that other friends or whatever, and they would start actually singing praise songs to these pagan gods. Okay? In a lot of ways, it's a lot like Annandale on Friday night. Okay? If you drive through Annandale on a summer night, there's going to be a whole lot of drinking and a whole lot of music. And for some reason, people feel the need to share this with the public, the general public. Okay? And so that's the word that is used there. And so it's, orgies. Okay, the next one, drinking parties. Drinking parties, apparently, is not just limited to college campuses. Okay, it's not just something that happens in George Mason on Friday nights, or any other campus, on any other college campus on Friday nights. But it's apparently something that happened also in the ancient Roman Empire, where you go to a party, and these drinking parties were a little bit different from other parties, I guess, in that I guess they might have food, but it would be more like snacks. They wouldn't have dinner food, they would have like snack food. But what they would have a lot of is a lot of alcohol. Okay? So, so it was a party where you can go, and most the people that are walking into this party know that they're going to get drunk. Okay. So that is something that occurred then. It happens a lot today. Doesn't make it right. And then lastly, abominable idolatry, which is a little bit of a... You would think it's in that list, it's a little bit of a disconnect, because he's talking about kind of wild living, drinking, and all of this stuff going on. And then all of a sudden he kind of shifts a little bit and says, and idol worship. It seems a little bit of a disconnect, but I think he does that on purpose, because he's saying all of these things, when we worship idols in our hearts, this is how it plays out. Okay, when we say there is no God, we do these things and it's okay in our minds. Okay? One of the saddest and I guess and the most horrifying things I learned in apologetics class was we had to learn a lot about the 20th century modern philosophers who were either agnostic or atheist. And when I say agnostic or atheist, these guys were hardcore. Most people you meet in the street and they say, yeah, I'm an atheist. When push comes to shove, they actually have a lot of assumptions about God and His goodness. These guys, they believed in atheism, they preached atheism, and they actually lived it out. And the way their lives turned out was pretty horrific. Some of these guys died from drug overdose in a crack house. Famous philosopher, books to his name, doing conferences and stuff, and then they found his body in a crack house, died of an overdose. Which makes sense, because this is exactly what he's saying. He's saying, there's no God. You're God. And so if that's true, then you can do whatever the heck you want. And there is no real meaning to your life or your existence apart from what you give it. Okay? And so the fact that Peter puts in that idol worship in the end, I think it's a good bookend to that one section, because he's saying, hey, if you are an idol worshiper, right, then all of these things are very natural to you. Now, before we can kind of stand on our holy ground and say, those terrible, terrible pagans, those disgusting sinners, Peter is reminding the first audience and also us, hey, this is the kind of stuff that we used to do. We might not have gone to drinking parties, okay? Although we did survive George Mason, okay? We did participate in these things in some way, shape, or form. And we were guilty of idol worshiping. And if we were all really, really honest in this room, a lot of us still have idols. One confession to give you guys as a pastor is that pastors, the biggest idols that we serve is church or ministry success. The pastors that at the biggest churches, they need a lot of prayer, because they can quickly worship the idol of their own ministry success. Okay, and that is a very real and dangerous thing. I had a chance to go to a seminar yesterday, led by Scotty Smith. He was a retired pastor down in Tennessee, and he planted a church in I think 86, 87, something like that, and it became pretty huge, became very, very successful in modern church standards. Okay, he had a lot of very famous contemporary Christian artists who are members of his church. And he shared this story that right before they officially launched the church, his mentor said this. He said, Scotty, be careful, because we're planting a church and it's going to be gospel-centered, it's going to be awesome, people are going to come and know Christ. But if you're not careful, this church will be the most seductive mistress you'll ever have. He was like, he said it kind of like, what? I'm about to go out there and, you know, like we're about to do this thing. And you're telling me this now? Okay. And so we're not immune from these things. It's easy for us to look at this and be like, I don't do that. I don't have to worry about that. But as young high school students often tell me and remind me, the Bible is written for a reason, and the things that God put in the Bible are there for a purpose. Okay, and so God is not wasting these words. So when He's saying this to us, we have to remember that there is a reason. Now we move into the second half of the message, where we talk about focus specifically on verse 4, and we break it down into three parts. First is that they are surprised, okay? So now, what he's going to do is, Peter's going to show the the differentiation, the difference between a believer and an unbeliever, and the main deciding factor would be Christ. Okay, and so he says they are surprised, meaning unbelievers are surprised, especially or specifically at the fact that we as Christians no longer do what we used to do. Okay, and what that means, it comes out in a lot of different ways. For me personally, in high school, I specifically remember, I think it was either 9th grade or 10th grade. I think it was 9th grade. I was in Richmond, in a foreign city, in the state of Virginia, in a foreign state. I had just come from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, okay, where I was told ever since I was in 3rd grade that Benjamin Franklin is the most brilliant man that ever lived on the planet. And in fact, it was Benjamin Franklin that was the father of the Revolutionary War and the reason why we are an independent, democratic, awesome country today. I moved to Virginia, and the first thing I hear from my history teacher is, no, in fact, it's actually Thomas Jefferson who is the reason why we are a free and awesome, democratic country that we are today. Okay, so it was a little bit of a cultural shift. Nonetheless, I had come to know Christ in the summer of my, after my 7th grade and right before my 8th grade. And so going into 9th grade, whole new surroundings, new friends, new everything. And what I decided was, because I'm a Christian and I love Jesus, what I'm going to do is I am not going to curse like a sailor like all of my friends are. Okay? That's a very big step. Okay? Because if you live in Philadelphia, you know that no matter whether you're living in the city or you're living right outside the city, it doesn't matter. If you're a boy, and you know, you're kind of like playing with your friends and you're getting into sports and stuff, you got to learn how to talk trash. Okay? It's just the way of life there. Okay? And if you don't talk trash, you will get physically hurt. Okay? Because it's just like you're dumb. Okay? You're not defending yourself. And so for me, that was a very big step. I'm going to make a stand for Christ. I am not going to curse. And so I made a point that I actually like came up with words to substitute for different words. Right? So I used to say freaking a lot, and there's still remnants of that. I stopped saying that too, because it just gets really bad, because after a while, you know exactly what I'm trying to say. I just don't say it. Anyway, I decided I'm not going to curse. That's a very bad thing, and I'm just not going to do it. And I didn't think anybody would notice. Until one day after lunch, my friend Wes, asked me after lunch, we were going walking back to math class, and I distinctly remember this, it was so shocking. And he actually said, "Hey, I noticed that you never curse." But the way he said it was like, it wasn't even just like curiosity, it was like, what's wrong with you? Like, do you have a terminal disease or something? Like, you just can't say curse words or something? What's going on? You know? And he's like, I think he actually said, like, do you not know any curse words or something? You know? And that drives home this point, that they are surprised. That when you don't do the things that our unbelieving friends do, they're very surprised. You know, I had a cousin who went to Korea for a year to teach English. And she came, ultimately she came back. She was making a lot of money, she was making good money. And she ultimately came back after 1 year, and she said the main reason why she came back was because if you go in the Korean culture, the Korean working culture, you have to go drinking with your coworkers every day. And she just wouldn't do it. And at first, it was the coworkers were like, "What? What do you mean? Like, you're not gonna drink? What's going on?" You know? And it's that kind of thought. So the world thinks that we're weird when we don't run after money, power, sex, status, etc., etc., etc. And so, we don't run after the things that the world runs after, because we run after one thing, which is Christ. And so this is one thing that we can check ourselves with. Our actions and our goals. Is it more Christ-like? Or is it more like our non-Christian friends? The second part of verse 4 says, you do not run with them. In the literal Greek, it literally says, you do not run in the same flood or into the same flood. And that just refers to the idea that once you become a Christian, once you have come to know Christ, our friends and our crew, when I say crew, I mean, I'm talking about like your core friends. It has to change. You know? When you come to know Christ and your crew is still all about like going drinking and doing drugs and selling drugs and stuff like that, there's a little bit of a disconnect. Because you can't be a Christian with a clear conscience and still do those things. That just doesn't make sense. You're just killing your soul. Okay? And so we see an example of that in Psalm 1:1, where it says this: how blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, stand in the path of sinners, or sit in the seat of scoffers. Okay? That whole idea, right? Or as one pastor once said, birds of a feather flock together. What does that mean? It means this: you don't see mallards flying together with Canada geese. Okay? You see a flock of Canada geese, they're flying with a bunch of Canada geese. Okay? You see a flock of mallards, they're flying with a bunch of mallards. Alright? And so it's that same idea that you run with the same type of people, right? And so if you say you're a Christian, but then you look at your crew and see what they're like, it's like, you gotta ask yourself, what am I doing here? I remember in high school and in college, pastors and older brothers would usually say, give us the young guys the advice in terms of like dating advice and marital advice. They would say this. They would say, when you see a girl and you like her because she's pretty, okay, ladies, just straight up, when a guy first likes you, he's just looking at nothing else than he just thinks you look good. I just be real honest, okay. But the problem is, if we really like you and we want to take it to the next step, the next thing is we got to get the guts to ask you out. Problem is, we have no idea who you are or what you're about, other than the fact that you look good. Okay? And so the advice that I received was that the easiest and the best way to get a snapshot of the girl's character is look at her friends. Look at the people that she hangs out with. And talk to them and see what they're like. Okay, so if she's all like, right, like, I mean, they're all fantastic, right? The ladies are just born naturally fantastic. Sin just doesn't corrupt you as much as corrupts guys, okay? So even like Nathan, he's corrupt, okay? A lot more than girls. But if she can be clean, nice, and holy and all of that stuff, but then like, you look at her friends and her circle of friends that she's running with, and it's like drinking party like 8 out of 7 days of the week. You know, because Fridays counts as a double. Right? There's round 1 and 2. You know what I mean? And so then you gotta ask yourself, you're like, okay. You know, like she could have like the best Christian like profile on Facebook. You know, she could put up Bible verses. But that doesn't tell you her character. In the same way, ladies, guys do the same thing. We can act all super holy in front of you guys, but if you guys really want to know what we're like, look at the friends that we have and what our friends are like. Thankfully, Peggy didn't judge me exclusively on my friends, because my friends are idiots. Okay, all of them. And that's why most of them are still single. Anyway, this is going to be on the internet. It's okay, and I'm not going to have any more friends after this. Nonetheless, birds of a feather flock together. Simple idea. Okay. Lastly, you are maligned or abused. Okay. So notice the progression. First, the unbelieving unbelievers are surprised that, especially that they don't, that we don't do the things that we used to do, especially with them, and then so they move from surprise to anger and hatred. Okay. So you are maligned or abused in some of the other translations. And what that means is, it comes out in different ways, but ostracizing, like when you come to Christ, you will lose friends. Sorry to say. Not to say that if a person is no longer friends with you, then, you know, they're godless heathens and they're destined for hell. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is, the people that used to be your best friends, when you come to Christ and you start changing, don't be surprised that they start leaving. Okay? And when they leave, they don't leave politely. They don't leave quietly. When they leave, they want to cause as much pain and agony as possible. Thankfully, I didn't really have to deal with that. I think God was very gracious. Because the friends that I had growing up, it was only like two or three that were kids in my neighborhood my age playing football and basketball together. And then I moved to Richmond when I was in high school, so I had to start all over anyway. Honestly, some of you might not be surprising, but in high school, I didn't really have any much friends in school. I had maybe two. Yeah, I had two. I had two friends the first 2 years of high school. My third and fourth year, I made a third friend, a kid I used to hate because I thought he was just super annoying. Until we got in this huge, like, argument in art class about religion, and we both realized we loved Jesus, and so we became the best of buds, and it was kind of funny, but that was my third friend, because most of my friends were in youth group, okay, and some of those friends I still keep in touch with, and I'm very proud to call them my friends, and so I never had to personally go through this experience of, oh my God, you're a Christian now, so you're totally different, so what the heck? And I'm very thankful for that, because I know my friends that I met in college and stuff like that, that they, you know, they had a very difficult time. And I think the most difficult times for, at least in our current American context, is the abuse and the hatred that we feel from our family members. You know, I've had students who had hell of a time with family members, parents, siblings, cousins, and I always, you know, some of you guys heard the story about this one student I had in my first church. His dad was very, very smart guy, made a lot of money being a very smart guy. Problem was, he didn't know Christ. He just came to church to tick the box. But the problem was, his son came to faith. And so the problem started when this kid came to faith, was reading his Bible at home, asked his dad a question that dad didn't know. And so in response, the dad said, you are no longer allowed to go to Bible study. And so this kid started making deals with his dad. Dad, if I do this science fair, if I do this extracurricular activity, and if I come in first place, can I go to church? So he would enter into every single academic bowl, science fair, all of that stuff that his school offered, and he would enter, and he would win most of it. We know this because we would see it in the newspaper in a couple of days, because he would show up on Friday and be like, hey, what are you doing here? Like, yeah, I made a deal with my dad. You know? Jesus says in John 15, 18, the night he was betrayed, says, the world hated me first, and it will hate you too. And so all of that just to say, we are nothing but justified sinners. The only difference between us and an unbeliever is Christ. But that difference is pretty huge. So much so that that difference, the world will hate us for it. We're not losing our heads and our family members and our houses and our businesses for it, as some of our brothers and sisters are in other parts of the world. But nonetheless, we still face that that differentiation. But our hope then is in verse 5, where Peter says, don't worry. We have a God who justified us, declared us righteous because of Christ. At the same time, when the time comes, he's going to declare them unrighteous. He's going to judge them. He's going to come against sin. And so though we are suffering, we are still victorious. In life, we are victorious. In death, we remain undefeated. So this is what it means to live as justified sinners. Let's pray.